We now pick it up today is the question of how we attract the spiritual forces which our writings tell us permeate the entire creation. And how do we attract those spiritual forces in a constructive way which enables us to develop our spiritual natures? This is a complex subject. It involves our understanding of the interaction of the material and spiritual worlds, and that is quite complex. Fortunately, it has been made incredibly simple. It has been made incredibly simple through the use of a very powerful analogy by Abdu'l-Bahá, and to a lesser extent, it appears in the writings of Baha'u'lláh. By the use of that analogy, what is otherwise complex becomes quite straightforward, and we are put in a position of being able to understand it to a large extent and to apply it very happily. And that thing is called the magnetic principle. And I want to read to you what Abdu'l-Bahá says about it and then spend the rest of the time discussing it. Abdu'l-Bahá says in his writings, and I'll quote it, it's a fairly short passage, he says, when existing elements are gathered together according to the natural order and with perfect strength, they become a magnet for the spirit, and the spirit will become manifest in them with all its perfections. This is quite simple and quite straightforward, but it has profound implications, as we will see. Firstly, what Abdu'l-Bahá is saying, as I understand it, is that one takes existing elements, the elements of the periodic table or whatever, the ordinary elements you find around the place, and we arrange them according to the natural order. What does that mean? My understanding is that it means that if we take existing elements and arrange them in a pattern that conforms to divine law, then the result is that the thing becomes a magnet for the spirit, and it manifests the spirit. What do we mean by divine law? It seems to me that there are two sources of divine law accessible to us in this realm of existence. One source of divine law is the law of nature. And you find in the writings reference to the will of God expressed through the laws of nature. So one form of divine law is that of nature. The other form is that given to us by the authentic teachings of the manifestations of God. So what we're saying really is not particularly complicated. All we're saying is that if you follow divine law, either the law of nature or the law of the manifestation, if you follow divine law and arrange elements in the right pattern, it will attract the spirit in a way similar to magnetism. And our role as Baha'is is to use this knowledge of divine law, either through nature or through the manifestation, in order to attract the spirit so we can develop ourselves spiritually. Nowadays, magnetism is commonplace. You could take any town or city in the whole of New Zealand from one end to the other, and if you went into somebody's home and got as far as their refrigerator, you'll find magnets covering the door. There are all kinds of magnets around the place. People have advertising things on magnets, and at the end of the year, real estate agents send you calendars with a magnet attached to them, so on. So magnets are very commonplace to us. We take them for granted. But if you read the history of science in the 13th century and thereabouts, people puzzled enormously over what was a magnet. Why is something a magnet and something else is not? If you took iron, in some cases the iron was magnetized, in other cases it wasn't. What was profoundly mysterious was the fact that if you took two magnets of the appropriate polarity and held them reasonably close to each other, there was a force of attraction between them. And that force is invisible. Bring your hand between it. Of course, you need three hands to do that, but that doesn't matter. You run your third hand between the two hands holding the magnets, and lo and behold, there's nothing there. You don't feel anything between the two magnets, but there is a force, and that force is inclining the two magnets to come together with a bang. And we take it for granted. It's commonplace, it's straightforward, nobody becomes too excited about it, but it was something very, very curious that people puzzled over. Philosophers of the 13th century wrote about this mysterious, invisible force generated as a result of the creation of a magnet. And it is therefore quite appropriate that Abdu'l-Bahá, and as they say to a lesser extent Baha'u'lláh, used the concept of magnet to explain spirit as an invisible force generated under appropriate conditions and manifesting itself very tangibly in the world around us. We know that magnetism can indeed be an extremely powerful force. In certain parts of the world, such as Shanghai and elsewhere, they have what they call the maglev train from one of the airports in Shanghai into the downtown area. And it functions according to magnetism to retain a distance between the train and the track, which reduces friction, of course, and the thing zips along at some high speed. So magnetism is not just refrigerator doors, it is also powerful forces which are at work in locomotives as well as in all kinds of other industrial machinery. What we find is that we, in the science and particularly in the physics, study magnetism from the effect it produces. Many years ago, I used to teach at the University of Michigan in the United States, and I taught a program of courses on what was called electromagnetism. And this was a program of courses that occupied several years, I think 3 or 4 years sequence, in which it went into the subject very deeply. In the initial phases of the subject, one worked with students who were not going to specialize in that area, so they just had to do it to satisfy some requirements. In the later stages, there were students who were very interested in the subject. And in the later stages, it was very easy to teach. Just went in and put a whole bunch of equations on the board, and you'd say to them, these are what was called Maxwell's equations. And you start off from that and went on, and then several months later, masses of algebra would be generated and people would regurgitate that appropriately and go on to the next course. But I also taught the course to initial undergraduates who had no great interest in the subject except getting through it and getting out the door. And they were very difficult because they raised fundamental questions. For example, they would say to me, okay, what's electricity? And I'd then respond by spewing out a whole bunch of equations. and they'd listen patiently, and they'd say to me, you know, that's not the question I asked. I don't want to know how it functions or how you predict it or how you measure anything like that. I want to know what it is. And I would respond with another set of equations which were equally unsatisfactory to them. And eventually, after going back and forth, which generally involved quite a lot of discussion out in the corridor or in the coffee shop or something like that, I would surrender. And I would say, we really don't know what it is. All we can do is say, this is how it behaves. This is how electricity behaves. This is how magnetic forces behave. This is how protons and neutrons and electrons and all kinds of other things react in relation to each other. In other words, all we can do is examine this subject by its effect rather than try to penetrate the mystery of what is positive and negative charge and magnetic force and the like. So it is in this area of the analogy set out by Abdu'l-Bahá. We can study the effect of the spirit in terms of what it does, what its effect is. And if somebody says, okay, that's great, I've read all that stuff, now tell me, what is spirit? Then that is the time for our friend around here to ring the bell, and sorry, it's lunchtime. Because we don't know what it is. We say it permeates the whole of creation. As we see this morning, we can understand it by its effect and what it does, but not what it is. All of that is part of the mystery of religion. So this analogy of Abdu'l-Bahá has made a mysterious subject palatable. We can live with it. We can work with it. We have tons of magnets attached to refrigerator doors. We're familiar with it. It doesn't frighten us. We can use it in any way we like. And so it is. The magnetic analogy enables us to use the various elements of our religion in order to get some degree of understanding of the attraction of matter attracting spirit. Now let's go on, and by the end of this session, you'll be so sick and tired of the word magnetism, you'll be ready for your coffee. The writings tell us that, now it starts off simple and then it starts to mess the thing up, make it more complicated. It tells us that spirit is manifested in various forms. And these forms depend upon how we arrange the elements according to what Abdu'l-Bahá says is natural order. If we arrange the elements in a certain order, you get this category of spirit. If you arrange the elements in that kind of order, you get that category of spirit. And Abdu'l-Bahá tells us that there are several categories of spirit. Some of you will have read this already. It may not be news to you. I'm going to do it reasonably quickly because it'll take me off in another direction. We have what's called the mineral spirit. If you arrange the atoms in a certain way, you have a mineral. Arrange the atoms in another way, according to the divine order, and you have a vegetable. So on, you have an animal, the human spirit, and the like. And Abdu'l-Bahá describes these as various categories of spirit, each one manifested according to the way you arrange the atoms. By you arrange the atoms, I don't mean you sit down and tinker with one atom after the other, get it all in the right shape. It is part of the natural order of the universe. He tells us that the mineral, for example, he says, as to the existence of spirit in the mineral, it is clear that minerals are endowed with spirit and life according to the requirements of that stage. A pretty radical idea. This poor old watch of mine has life to it. It has a spirit to it. It's not just a bunch of metal. It has a mineral spirit associated with it. And likewise with vegetables and animals and the like. Abdu'l-Bahá goes on to point out that the one universal principle in spirit appearing in these various categories is that it is governed by the law of love. Abdu'l-Bahá says, "Love is the most great law that ruleth this mighty and heavenly cycle, the unique power that bindeth together the divine diverse elements of this material world." And then he goes on to say, "Love is the supreme magnetic force directing the movement of spheres in celestial realms." So he relates the manifesting of spirit in the various categories of creation, relates that to love. He goes on to point out that by love he means the power of attraction. Abdu'l-Bahá says, "This stone is the lowest degree of phenomena, but nevertheless within it is a power of attraction, manifest without which the stone could not exist. This power of attraction in the mineral world is love. The only expression of love the stone can manifest." Okay, what we're talking about here is the manifesting of spirit in the mineral realm of creation. And Abdu'l-Bahá seems to me is saying that it's manifested through the power of attraction or cohesion. We create a mineral, it's not of tiny little atoms all spread out all over the place. There is cohesion. It is a big hunk of stone that you have in front of you or the like. There is a power of attraction and cohesion. At a deeper level, we can say that that manifesting of spirit in the mineral is apparent at the atomic and subatomic level in the way the elements, say, of the nucleus, the protons and the neutrons, are attracted to each other and stick together, and the way the electrons whiz around the nucleus, or what scientists refer to as the various forces in the atom, the weak nuclear force and the strong nuclear force, and gravitation and electromagnetic attraction, all these kinds of things we don't need to go into. But nevertheless, attraction is the key thing in the manifesting of love in the various categories of creation, and the basic level is that of the mineral. He goes on to point out that the plant has the power of absorption from the earth. It has a higher degree of attraction which differentiates the plant from the mineral. The plant doesn't just attract whatever's lying around, it sends out roots and picks up all kinds of trace elements that it needs in order to grow. It has a greater power of attraction. To the kingdom of the vegetable, this is an expression of love. So what he seems to be pointing out is that love is universal. It's manifested in attraction. For a mineral, it's just the fact the thing hangs together. For a vegetable, it's the fact that it attracts elements and it grows. He goes on to speak about the animal world, and here he says the power of love makes itself still more manifest. Light of love is resplendent in the animal kingdom because the power of attraction, whereby certain elements cohere and cellular atoms commingle, now reveals itself in certain emotions and sensibilities which produce instinctive fellowship and association. And here I think what I get from this is Abdu'l-Bahá is pointing out that this power of attraction occurs in the animal realm as well as in the vegetable and the mineral realm, but it has a different form in each category. And then, of course, he puts the crown in the whole thing by saying man is the possessor of a degree of attraction which is conscious and spiritual. Here, in an immeasurable advance, the human kingdom's spiritual susceptibilities come into view. Love exercises its superlative degree, and this is the cause of human life. So he unites the various manifestations of spirit throughout creation as each one dependent upon the arrangement of the atoms in a certain order, according to divine order, and that then attracts spirit of a certain kind. So it's a unified view of the attraction of spirit to the creation. And as we'll see presently, that we go beyond the human spirit by referring to the spirit of faith, which we attract by our actions in making ourselves into magnetic attractors, and that's coming in a few minutes. But nevertheless, what he's saying is that it's all an expression of love. And the way love is expressed by a mineral is not that the mineral sends you a dozen roses and a box of chocolates, but rather that the mineral expresses its love through the fact that it has the power of attraction of elements all around it. Before we go on to develop this Abdu'l-Bahá's ideas on magnetism, let me make one comment, in fact, two comments. Firstly, most of what I'm presenting in this series of sessions is taken from the tablet to Dr. Forel. It's a tablet of Abdu'l-Bahá, which he wrote, I think, in 1920 or 1921, and it's not easy to find it. India produced this giant thing of writings and utterances of Abdu'l-Bahá, you know, about 3 or 4 inches wide, and you'll find it's there, and it's in some other places as well, but that's probably the most accessible place. And in addition, you find that what he says in the tablet to Dr. Forel echoes things that Abdu'l-Bahá says in some answered questions and various other places scattered throughout the writings. Second comment I want to make is that as we proceed, we can take a slight detour and talk about human beings. Abdu'l-Bahá says these elements, the composition which is found in the organism of man, is an attraction and magnet for the spirit. It is certain that the spirit will appear in it, so a mirror which is clear will attract the rays of the sun. He goes on to point out again about human beings. Existence of beings is conditioned upon the coming together of various elements and their non-existence upon the decomposition of constituent elements. For the composition causes the dissociation of the various elements. What I understand from that is that the formation of human beings, pregnancy to death, is an application of the magnetic principle. That when you arrange the atoms in an appropriate way, when the ovum is fertilized by the spermatozoa, then that arrangement of atoms of the fertilized ovum attracts the human spirit. And then later, when you get old and decrepit and you die, the elements disassociate and the human spirit is no longer associated with that magnet, with that element. Abdu'l-Bahá points out that in the case of the other manifestations of spirit, the spirit is annihilated with the dissociation. With the human spirit, it's not. It goes on to the next world. So the pattern of analogy breaks down at a certain point. This is quite interesting because there are a number of questions that are unsolved in the Baha'i teachings. One is the question of the test tube baby. And every so often somebody writes to the Universal House of Justice and says, I know there's all kinds of work going on about creating life in the test tube, and is that valid from a Baha'i perspective, and will they succeed? We're not talking about frozen embryos or anything like that. We're talking about starting off with inanimate material and creating literally in the test tube a fertilized ovum from which human life can come. Obviously it can't be done yet, and the question that has arisen, people have written to the House of Justice and said, will it ever be possible? And the response of the House of Justice, as I recall it, has been that we should let science proceed and it'll become clear with the progress of science, rather than the faith giving a ruling on that subject. One can argue it one way or the other. You could take these passages and say, if at some time in the future human beings are able to create a pattern which conforms to the divine order, then that would be the right pattern to attract the human spirit, and lo and behold, you would create human life in the test tube. The people who argue against it would say it's impossible to replicate the divine order. You may get 98% of it or 99.5% of it, but that's not 100% of it, and that would not attract the human spirit. And the argument is open. And as the House of Justice says, let time proceed, and as science advances, it'll become clear. The other question, which also is an open question, is the question of life in other parts of the universe. We certainly do have the statements of Gleanings and some other places concerning the fact that life is not confined only to this planet Earth, but in other parts of the universe. What is unclear from the writings is what form that life takes, whether there will in fact be little green men on Mars or whether there won't be. And there again, that is a question open to interpretation and open to the discoveries of astronomy and other sciences in the future. There is nothing in the Baha'i writings that is definitive about the nature of that life. We do have the various categories, including the human category, and one can say, well, that extends to other kinds of humans. What other kinds of humans remain to be determined? It is an open subject. You'll find in recent weeks or months, there's been articles in the news about the discovery of rudimentary forms of life in areas where you would say it's impossible because there's a lack of oxygen or lack of the appropriate temperature range or very high radioactivity like around Chernobyl or something like that, and yet you find life existing. So people are starting to revise their ideas of life and the conditions for its evolution or existence, and all of those things pertain to this issue here that we're looking at this morning about the creation of or attraction of life, attraction of the human spirit through the divine order. But they're questions we cannot answer. There's nothing about them explicit in the writings, but they're open questions which no doubt will be explored more fully during the course of this dispensation. But that was a kind of a detour. What I want to do now is to go back to the main part of my subject, which is that how we can attract the power of the Holy Spirit through the operation of the magnetic principle. And I want to take a number of examples which are drawn largely from Abdu'l-Bahá. The first is a beautiful example taken from the writings of Abdu'l-Bahá, in which he describes the manifestation of God himself as being a magnet. Abdu'l-Bahá says, "The Lord has manifested the magnet of the souls and hearts in the pole of the existing world, to which all sacred hearts are attracted from far distant lands and countries. Thank thou God for being so attractable a body to be drawn to the magnet of the kingdom of God. And this is a very beautiful and illuminating analogy, referring to the fact that when the manifestation appears in the world, as Baha'u'llah has done, that he himself is a magnet with spiritual forces associated with him which attract us to the manifestation. One is reminded of the passage in the Book of Certitude where it says that we are attracted to the city of God by the fragrance of its perfume across some incredible distance. I can't remember that one, that the tablet of the true seeker, about the person who is spiritually prepared and will be attracted to the manifestation across this incredible distance, simply by, not by what the manifestation says or his offering of proofs or illuminating teachings, but rather by the very presence, the very nature of the manifestation, generating a spiritual power that attracts the individual. The classic example from the Baha'i writings is Qudus. And you remember from Dawnbreakers, the story of Qudus, the letter of the living, the final one to be enrolled as the company of the letters of the living of the Bab. And as I recall, the story is that the Bab is speaking with Mullah Hussein the previous night, and he basically says, of course he speaks more politely than I do, he says, "We're one short, but one will come tomorrow where I'm communing with him already in the spiritual realm." Fine. Next afternoon, the Bab and Mullah Hussein comes to the end of the day and they're in Shiraz and they're returning to the home, the house of the Bab. The description of Nabil is quite detailed. And as I read it very carefully, it seems to be that the Bab is walking ahead and Mullah Hussein, in a very respectful way, is walking behind. That's quite significant. It means that Mullah Hussein sees the back rather than the face of the Bab. And while they're proceeding back to the house of the Bab in Shiraz, lo and behold, this young man turns up. And he's dirty and dusty and he's been travelling a long time and he needs a good wash and a rest. Look. And he comes racing up to Mullah Hussein and says, "Quick, where is he? Where's the promised one?" And Mullah Hussein, being very concerned for the young man's condition of exhaustion, says, okay, well, you know, they speak much more politely than I do. He says, okay, take it easy, settle down, draw your breath, have a wash, drink something, and then I'll take you to him. And the story in Dawnbreakers, which is far more poetic than I'm conveying, Qudus looks around and sees, I recognize him by the way he walks. And notice that it's not the face of the Bab that he sees. He sees the back of the Bab. The Bab is walking ahead and has his back to Qudus, but Qudus recognizes the Bab just by the presence, the very presence of the Bab. And that, to my mind, is an example of what is described here, that the manifestation of God is manifest as a magnet in the world. And spiritual forces attract those who are spiritually prepared, as they did in the case of Qudus. And you remember the rest of the story. Mullah Hussein leaves Qudus where he is, goes forward to the Bab and says, "This young man has turned up and he's very anxious to see you. Is it okay?" And the Bab says, "Send him to me. We've been communing already in the spiritual realm." So one of the examples, the primary example of magnet is that of the manifestation himself. The manifestation is endowed with mysterious spiritual powers beyond those accessible to you and I, and those spiritual powers are of a mysterious nature which attract us, just as a magnet will attract little bits of iron and metal around the place. Let's go on with magnets. As I say, you're going to be sick and tired of magnets by the end of this morning, but let's continue. We find that in some places the term lodestone is used to refer to magnet. L-O-D-E, not L-O-A-D, L-O-D-E, lodestone, which is a poetic term for magnet. Lodestone is used in the little magnets that you find where north is. You find Baha'u'llah says about his revelation, these holy verses are the most potent elixir, the greatest and mightiest talisman. This revelation is endowed with such a power that it will act as a lodestone for all nations and kindreds of the earth. We can corrupt the text by substituting the word magnet for lodestone. Presumably we can get away with it if nobody finds out. This revelation is endowed with such power that it will act as a lodestone or magnet for all the nations and kindreds of the earth. And here we have the use of the analogy of the magnet to indicate not the manifestation himself, but his revelation, that it is endowed with a spiritual power which attracts others to it, just as a magnet has the magnetic power associated with it. Without having to mess around with the authoritative text, we can quote Abdu'l-Bahá, where he refers to what he calls the divine magnet. The power of the Word of God will attract the hearts and bestow ecstasy and enthusiasm upon souls. So once again, reference to the revelation as being a magnet. This is very, very significant to us because we regard the revelation of God as having a mysterious spiritual power, and that concept of the revelation as having a mysterious spiritual power is captured by use of the analogy of the magnet. We have tons of places where it refers to the mysterious spiritual power of the revelation. For example, Baha'u'llah says, every single letter proceeding from our mouth is endowed with such regenerative power as to enable it to bring into existence a new creation, a creation the magnitude of which is inscrutable to all save God, and so on. Another place, Shoghi Effendi says, the words of Baha'u'llah and the Master have a creative power and are sure to awaken in the reader the undying fire of the love of God. What this means is that there is a deep and profound mystery to the revelation of the manifestation of God. It is not just like other stuff that you and I may write or read, or wise things that others may write. It is creative. It has a creative power associated with it as an expression of the magnetic principle. It's quite different from the words of human beings, and its understanding is limitless. There is no limit to the amount of understanding we can get from it. Sometimes one says to oneself, why do we describe the revelation of Baha'u'llah as having a mysterious creative power? Is it not simply words like other words? Take, for example, the Kitab-e-Ikan, the Book of Certitude. let's say 200 pages more or less. And we say it is the creative word. A skeptic says, come on, calm down. What do you mean creative word? Every word in the Kitabi Ikan, in the English translation, appears also in the Oxford English Dictionary. We don't say the Oxford English Dictionary has the creative word to it. It's as boring as could be. But we say that those same words, some of which appear in the Kitabi Ikan, have a creative, mysterious power, the power of regeneration and the like. How can that be? And the answer lies in pattern. The pattern of the words that appears in the Kitabi Ikan is a pattern that gives it, associated with it, a creative power. Yes, they are the same words that appear in the Oxford English Dictionary, but the pattern is different, and that pattern attracts the creative power. Thus, the magnetic principle. Remember what Abdu'l-Bahá said about when elements are arranged in a divine order, according to the natural order, it attracts the spirit. So in that sense, the words of the creative revelation are words which enable us to receive a creative power which is not apparent in any other way. All of this is part of the mystery of the revelation. It has a spirit associated with it. Part of the mystery is that its understanding is limitless. You never reach a point where you say, okay, I've finished with the Book of Certitude. What can I read next? I mean, you can say that because you want to read something else, that's fine. But one never is finished with it, just as devout Muslims are never finished with the Quran. They read it for 1,200 years and they're not finished with it. It's capable of an infinitude of meaning. And that, of course, underlies the philosophy of the five-year plan and the core activities in the RUI program, where we get together and we discuss the creative word. You never reach a point where it's finished. And sometimes people who, I guess it's no longer around the place, but for a few years there were people who kind of looked down on the RUI program and said, this is too simple. The hidden implication was that I'm a lot smarter than this and I need more complicated stuff to read than to read these RUI things in RUI book one or two or something like that. And the fallacy of that argument lay in the fact that there is no limit to the understanding one can get from even the simplest passage of the holy writings. In the prayer it says, I bear witness thou hast created me to know thee and to worship thee. Literally, we could spend a lifetime on that one passage of the knowledge of God and the worship of God and the various means by which it is done in science, in devotion, in our relations with each other, in music and art and 500 other things. So the revelation is mysterious in that manner. It also means that we read the revelation for two reasons. One is for the information. We want to know what life after death is discussed around the writings, so we look up the index and we read gleanings about life after death. We read the revelation for information, but we also read it for the spirit. There are times where you don't care too much about life after death. You just open the gleanings and read because you want to be bathed in the spirit of the creative word rather than getting information. One other thing that I have thought about is why is the revelation arranged the way it is? Take, for example, the Kitabi Ikan. If you were and I were writing the Kitabi Ikan, God help us, the world would end. But let's assume you and I decided we would write the Kitabi Ikan. we'd begin by setting up some kind of outline of chapters, headings and subheadings. You'd organize it. You'd collect all this stuff of the interpretations of sun, moon and stars and put it in the one place. It's now in about 15 different places scattered throughout the book. And Baha'u'llah comes back to it, leaves it and goes to something else, comes back to something else. The things about the true seeker would be a section on their own. The things about the relationship of the manifestation to God would be a section on its own, all together in the one place, the various prophecies collected. It's not so in the Kitab-e-Ikan. At first sight, when you read the Kitab-e-Ikan or examine it, it seems to be all jumbled together, if that's not sacrilege or anything like that. It all seems mixed up. And you get a little frustrated, you say, I wish it had been kind of organized or rearranged somewhat. I could study sun, moon and stars in one hit and be done with it, and then could go on with some other part of it. So I say to myself, what is the wisdom of the Kitab-e-Ikan revealed in such a manner? And the wisdom seems to be, as far as I can tell, that the act of revealing the revelation is the act of creation. That the revelation mirrors and reflects creation. And just as in creation, not all the gold is one place and not all the coal is another place, or the iron ore is one place, it's scattered all throughout the planet, so it is that you have this sense of creation throughout the revelation, and that human beings impose their own logic and order to it, just as we impose a logic and order to the mineral universe by going and mining all the coal and taking it to power stations and sending it to China or whatever. And so it is that the revelation mirrors creation, and therefore it has its own beauty and its own logic that transcends human logic. Yeah. Let's move on to the magnet and continue with it. The writings point out that the expression of faith is a magnet which draws spiritual powers. Abdu'l-Bahá says, faith is the magnet which draws the confirmations of the Merciful One. Service is a magnet which attracts the heavenly strength. And many other places where Abdu'l-Bahá refers to faith as a magnet attracting spiritual powers. What that means is that when we accept the manifestation of God, we are enjoined to have faith. And that will attract spiritual powers, which will act as a form of confirmation. Whereas if you accept the manifestation and say, I'm not sure why Baha'u'llah said this and why he said that, and maybe he made a mistake, or maybe he was having a bad day, or something like that, then that's not the kind of faith we want, and that doesn't attract the spiritual powers and confirmations. So we have to take the first move. We have to reach out and say, I have faith. I believe. What Baha'u'llah says is right. I don't understand it, but I have faith. If we do that, then the spiritual powers are attracted by the magnetic principle, and then we are confirmed and we attain spiritual powers which lead us to a deeper understanding. So you find some people who go through their whole life on the edge, not quite sure whether they believe or not, waiting for confirmation before they plunge in fully in the step of faith. And God is a lot more patient than we are, and he's had a lot more time to think about it. So you wait and it's too late. What we have to do is have faith and commit ourselves in faith to the manifestation, and then the spiritual powers are attracted to us by the magnetic principle. Abdu'l-Bahá describes prayer as a magnet. He says, the commemoration of God attracts confirmation and assistance like unto a magnet. As I say, I said you'll be sick and tired of magnet by the end of the hour. Well, here's another example that he describes this mysterious element of prayer as a magnet. Remember, I mentioned yesterday that to some people, prayer is a very strange phenomenon. A person goes into their bedroom or whatever, alone, and whispers certain words and comes out with a great sense of satisfaction. And you say to yourself, what's going on here? This person has simply been whispering certain words and no one else has heard, alone in their bedroom or some other room. But we know it is prayer, and that prayer recited with devotion has created a magnet. Remember what Abdu'l-Bahá said about when elements are arranged in a natural order, they become a magnet. The natural order here is the act of prayer, the act of devotion, the attitude of devotion, and in some cases, of course, with obligatory prayer, the appropriate genuflections. It all creates the magnet which attracts spiritual powers, and so one has created a magnet through which prayer operates. We go on. Unity. Abdu'l-Bahá says, unity and harmony is the magnet that draweth down the confirmations of God. Very, very significant to us. It is a source of understanding to us why we will go to considerable lengths to preserve unity. Not because we are necessarily as patient as we should be, but because we recognize that unity and harmony themselves attract spiritual powers, that by acting in a unified way, we are creating a pattern of divine order, creating a magnet which attracts spiritual powers. This also brings up a very important point. In considering unity and harmony, we have to recognize that Baha'u'llah was smart enough not to contradict himself. With you or me, you say, I've got a tape of his talk that he gave last year and he said the opposite. You know, we contradict ourselves, we forget. Whereas the writings have no contradiction within them. And that is crucial when we're considering unity and harmony. Because if we take unity and harmony alone, without the other passages of the writings, we can be led into contradiction. For example, we value unity and harmony immensely, but we also value adherence to principle and the operation of justice by our elected bodies, the local, national, and international. So we cannot say we're going to practice unity and harmony at the expense of adherence to principle or to justice. We're going to allow this person to get away with blue murder because otherwise we'll have disunity. That is a very invalid manner of thinking. We see adherence to principle and the application of justice by our elected bodies as the vehicle by which we progress to a greater level of unity. I remember some years ago, a Baha'i from another country wrote to the House of Justice, and she was in a terrible quandary. She was a member of the Baha'i community, her husband was a member of the Baha'i community, and the husband was beating her up pretty bad. She was subject to quite significant domestic violence. And she went to her local assembly and said, my husband is beating me up and we need to get him to stop. Well, the local assembly tried and the guy wouldn't stop. And the local assembly then said to her, just accept it, just swallow it, because otherwise it'll disrupt the unity of the community and will affect the image of the faith in this city. And she, for various reasons, decided to write to the House of Justice. I'm skipping over a number of things here. Write to the House of Justice, and the House of Justice response has been published. It's been published quite extensively, and it's in this new fat book of Messages of the House of Justice from 1987 to 2001. And you find the House of Justice basically says, no way that we have to follow principle. We have to follow justice and the laws of Baha'u'llah, and that will lead to a greater reputation for the faith and a higher level of admiration for the consistency of adherence to principle than any other way. Don't cover it up. Don't hide it. Don't pretend it doesn't exist. Follow it through. Let the chips fall where they may, confident that the law of Baha'u'llah will produce a greater measure of unity. And so where there is delinquency in a Baha'i community, in that area as well as other areas, the faith is clear in terms of its unyielding adherence to principle without regarding that as a contradiction to the preservation of unity and harmony in the community. And you find many other examples such as that, where somebody is acting in a dictatorial manner, or sometimes there is a dictatorial attitude on the part of a group of believers in a community, and that preserves unity because you're too frightened to open your mouth, basically. And the House of Justice has ruled on such cases that we have to follow the principles of the faith, even though that causes a temporary disruption. Teaching the faith. Abdu'l-Bahá says, when the tongue of the teacher is engaged in teaching, he will naturally himself be stimulated, will become a magnet attracting the divine aid and bounty of God. And he says it again similarly in other places. Abdu'l-Bahá says, be thou engaged in teaching the truth, for teaching the cause containeth the power of a magnet. It attracts the mysteries of God. So once again, we have this magnetic principle of Abdu'l-Bahá, that you carry out actions in conformity with divine order and you create a magnet. Here the individual engages in teaching the faith or attempts to teach the faith, or he or she finds that they have created in themselves a magnet to attract others through their effort and commitment to teaching the faith. And of course, we have innumerable examples, more than you want to know about, of how individuals strive to teach the faith, and the act of striving attracts people to the cause, irrespective of the quality of their presentation or the illuminating way in which they present the teachings. They create a magnet to attract others to the cause. They become a magnet. I'm reminded, we've got a few minutes, let me tell this little story fairly quickly. Some years ago, Janet and I went to a place called Waxahachie, Texas. Nobody's heard of Waxahachie. You've heard of Waxahachie, Texas, for crying out loud. Okay. Sure hope you don't know anybody there. This was a number of years ago, and the believers there are no longer around, so I can defend myself this way. We went to Waxahachie, Texas, out of Dallas, and visited the Baha'i community there. And we found that there was basically an Iranian couple, and I guess two kids, who lived in Waxahachie, Texas, maybe a lot more people now, but there was an Iranian couple there who'd come as refugees, and they were engaged in teaching the faith. And a number of people had become Baha'is, which was wonderful because this Iranian couple were very devoted. What was curious was that, excuse me saying this, their English was terrible. And the man was a very devoted and enterprising man, but his English was disastrous. Nevertheless, a whole bunch of people had been taught the faith. And I was very curious about that. I said, how is it that anybody would be attracted to the faith when you can't understand him? So I had spent a little time in Waxahachie, and I visited with some of the fairly new Baha'is, and as I got to know them, I said very politely, what is it that attracted you to the faith? And they said, it was this gentleman. And I said, well, what did he say that you found so attractive? I was trying to be polite and not to be judgmental and all the rest of it. And they said, well, let me tell you what happened. And what he did, you shouldn't do. You know, I said, we'll have National Assembly on our back very quickly. What he would do is if he would stand outside his house in a street in Waxahachie, and he'd see people driving by, and it wasn't a very busy town in those days, and whenever he saw them driving by, he'd wave them down. So he does some poor soul minding his own business, driving along the road in Waxahachie, and there's this character. And it was a country town, and so people would stop, and somebody needs some help, and they'd come and stop and park the car on the side of the road, and then our friend would come over and he'd tell them about the faith. Okay, what did he say? The new Baha'i said, I didn't know what he said. And I said, okay, you didn't know what he said, how come you're a Baha'i? And he said, I looked in his eyes and I saw sincerity and belief. And as I thought about it, I said to myself, that is the magnetic principle. That it is not what you say, it is the mysterious spiritual power. And that this very fine gentleman, he was attracting people not by the logic of what he said, not by the brilliance of his exposition. Maybe brilliant if you can understand it, but nobody can understand it. But it wasn't that, it was the spiritual power he manifested as a magnet that attracted others. So we have these statements of the writings about becoming a magnet in teaching the faith, and the point I make is that it's a mysterious spiritual process. It's not a logic. Obviously, be as logical as possible and try to speak a language that the local population can understand and all that kind of stuff, but nevertheless, the bottom line is that you become a magnet through the sincerity of effort, and that transcends logic, and spiritual powers are manifested through this process of teaching the faith. Finally, we come to our friend cleanliness. Remember, I mentioned this yesterday, and I mentioned it as one of the mysterious elements of the faith. It becomes somewhat clearer when we invoke the magnetic principle. Abdu'l-Bahá says, even in the physical realm, cleanliness will conduce to spirituality, as the holy writings clearly state. And Abdu'l-Bahá refers to the effect of purity and holiness, cleanliness and refinement on the exaltation of the human condition and the development of man's inner reality. Abdu'l-Bahá says, the fact of having a pure and spotless body exercises an influence on the spirit of man. My understanding of it is that he is here referring to the magnetic principle, that when we conform to the divine order, we attract a spiritual power to us. The divine order in this instance is cleanliness, And if we make an effort to be clean in whatever that means in various ways, that itself attracts a spiritual power, and that, as Abdul Baha says, the pure and spotless body exercise an influence on the spirit of man. We can go into a whole bunch of other things, psychological effects and physical effects of cleanliness and attitudinal effects on the individual, and the fact that people don't stand so far away from you if you're clean and all that kind of stuff. We can do those sorts of things, but nevertheless, the bottom line is that it is the magnetic principle. The act of making yourself clean attracts a spiritual power associated with the very actions you have taken, and that has a spiritual influence on your spirit as well as on those around you. So it becomes another example of the magnetic principle. Before I stop and receive any questions, let me summarize what we've done today. Basically, what we've said is that there is a magnetic principle set out by Abdul Baha, and that magnetic principle is in terms of arranging elements, which can include attitudes and the like, conforming to divine order, and Abdul Baha tells us that attracts the spirit, just as a magnet is attracted in that way, the magnetic force is attracted. And that this magnetic principle transcends the rationality of the materialistic outlook. What we're going now is going beyond the materialistic outlook by invoking the magnetic principle by referring to the attraction of spiritual powers. I remember some years ago at the World Centre, had a bunch of visitors who had come in busloads to visit the shrine, and usually they're running late and the tour guide rushes them through. And I was around there, and a group of non-Baha'i visitors to Israel who came, and they were running late, and so they came to the shrine of the Bab, and in those days non-Baha'i visitors could enter the shrine of the Bab now because of the crowds. It's not possible. Anyhow, and there were this group of individuals running late, and so one of them said, "I'll go in and see what's there." And the others waited outside. The individual who went inside came back and said, "There's nothing in there." So the others didn't need to bother going into the shrine of the Bab, and they could maintain their schedule and went off as they wished. And I remember being quite fascinated by that comment because it indicated a certain outlook by which there is nothing in the shrine of the Bab. There's nothing to see there. There's not even anything useful on the wall other than the tablet of visitation. It is basically an empty room. And someone from a materialistic outlook would find it very strange that Baha'is come from all over the world and take off their shoes and go in and put their forehead to the threshold of an empty room. And some of them weep, some of them are deeply moved by the empty room. And to me, it captured the essence of the outlook that we aspire towards of recognizing the existence of a spiritual world as well as a material world and wanting to attract its mysterious spiritual powers for our spiritual development. Okay, I think that finishes what I want to say today. Tomorrow, I want to go on and develop the magnetic principle somewhat further. We'll find that there is a complication which I've concealed from you, but which will be disclosed tomorrow, which will make things a little more complicated, but not too bad, but we'll have to survive it. And when we survive it, we'll have a somewhat fuller view of the magnetic principle. There's some things I want to that I've skirted around that we'll come to tomorrow.